In the Buddhist religion, the search for God is synonymous with the realization of our most compassionate self. The Buddha, like Jesus, lived a life that personified the path to divine selfhood. The Buddha was born a wealthy prince named Siddhartha, whose father wished to protect him from the cruelty and the suffering of life. To this end, he built walls around his palace, only allowing in the pleasures of the material world. But the young Siddhartha instinctively knew that there was more to life than what he saw within the confines of his father's palace, and he also knew that he needed to experience those things in order to become truly human. He left behind his beautiful wife and child, journeying beyond the walls of the palace to encounter human suffering for the first time. And with that, his journey to enlightenment began. Ultimately, the Buddha would reveal that untransformed human life is suffering, and out of that revelation would come enlightenment for millions. From his recognition that the palace walls we build around ourselves are merely holding the truth and meaning of human existence at bay, came his exhortation to recognize the suffering of the world. We must open our hearts before suffering, he claimed, in order to become genuine channels for its transcendence. We live in a prison, not a palace, when our hearts have not yet cracked open. But when the heart does crack open, when humanity's pain and suffering moves us to respond to it as passionately as we used to run away from it, then we are on our way to enlightenment at last. We realize our oneness with the angels as we offer ourselves to help them. Every time we say a prayer for someone, serve a meal to a homebound person with AIDS, hold the hand of a dying patient as a hospice volunteer, give a deserving, struggling employee another chance to get it right, or lobby our elected officials for more compassionate policies, we are tending to our own evolution. That which purports to be spiritual growth, but does not involve an act of compassion, is not really growth at all. Whether we're seeking to heal ourselves or our planet, we must commit acts of compassion that go beyond the individual, beyond what is convenient, and beyond the confines of the status quo. Individual acts of compassion and kindness will not of themselves provide enough loving energy to transform our civilization. Rather, we must make love the center of all our enterprises, collective as well as individual. When harmlessness toward life becomes a personal, social, economic, and political imperative, then we will be on our way at last to the restoration and regeneration of our civilization. We have an opportunity at this time in history to completely change the course of human society. That opportunity is not simply an option anymore. It is a gauntlet thrown down by the forces of history before a generation still not yet decided whether money and power or love and brotherhood should form the basis of our civilization. But we will decide, or life will decide for us. The human species will learn to become profoundly compassionate towards itself and toward all of life, for we will learn it through wisdom, or we will learn it through pain. But we will learn, because it's God's will that we become the people He has created us to be. It's not up to us where we're going, but how we get there and when is determined by every choice we make, every moment of every day. Part 3, A Life of Grace. Ritual. During the 20th century, the Western mind fell into a materialistic stupor, so enamored of visible, tangible complexities that invisible realities were shoved to the margins of our consciousness and our culture. Scientific truths were deemed real in an unassailable way, while spiritual truths were often thought to be superstitious relics of an age gone by. Fortunately, the pendulum always swings back, and at last we're emerging from the rationalistic fog of an over-secularized worldview. We are collectively remembering that we are spiritual beings, the remembrance itself, like Atlantis rising from a sea of ancient forgetfulness. It arises new, transformed, and cleansed of what it used to stand for, now recognized as both our mission and our joy. The material world can be a marvelous place, full of power and excitement, but it is not, even in its most intense manifestations, the world of ultimate truth. Only the truth of a radical fundamental love is inalterable and and eternal. Our own will may delay its expression, but love will always prevail. This is a truth we remember at the end of our lives, or perhaps at the end of the life of a loved one. It's the truth we see when the superficial preoccupations that compete for our attention and rob us of our life force begin at last to melt away. This truth is reaffirmed by our participation in holy ritual. A sacred ceremony casts a spell on our hearts. It reminds us who we are, thus releasing us to become who we are capable of being. Rituals provide points of genuine connection with what is most authentically true, in ourselves, in each other, and in God. They are portals to divine illumination, and the light we receive through them remains within us. Sacred ritual uplifts the meaning with which we have imbued a human experience, raising it to the realm of the divine. And it is in those places where we are most profoundly human that we are pregnant with divine possibilities. It's deeply human to give birth to a child. It's deeply human to grow into adolescence, to marry, to mature into our elder years, and to die. It's not an accident that traditional religious ceremonies take place in these moments. It's when we are most fully and vulnerably alive that our hearts cry out for an added dimension of soulfulness. It's when we are deeply touched by life that we most want to feel God's touch upon us. Holy ceremony marries the mortal and the immortal, the secular and the sacred, that from that point forward, the two shall be irrevocably connected inside us. When I was a child, I had a sense, as most children do, of the mysterious power of religious ritual. I loved being in synagogue, going to weddings, going to bar mitzvahs. I could feel the mystical energies they aroused within me. But as I grew older, I learned to forget the subtle vibrations of spiritual energy that emanate from moments of religious depth. Weddings became about bridal registries and pretty dresses, and baptisms became about baby gifts. I was not a child of God anymore, so much as a child of American culture. The world we live in is way too much with us. Materialism bombards us relentlessly, and we surrender to its dominance at a terrible price. For consciousness attunes itself to one realm or another. We either vibrate with the world, or we vibrate with spirit, and one casts out the other. The mind cannot serve two masters, and according to A Course in Miracles, we can be either host to God or hostage to the ego. A mystic has made a choice for love, more than willing to sacrifice a materialistic perspective for a far richer, more varied, and more harmonious picture. That doesn't mean, of course, that baby gifts are not important or that brides shouldn't get the right serving forks. It doesn't mean we shouldn't live in lovely houses or enjoy beautiful things. It simply means that a mystical worldview puts the world in perspective, with eternal things in first place and everything else in second place. A fancy wedding does not guarantee marital bliss, no matter how beautiful it is. But a genuinely sacred marriage ceremony, be it Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, or our own spiritual hybrid, has the spiritual power to weave two hearts together. When I was growing up, so many traditional rituals had become empty shells, performed perfunctorily by bored and boring officiants, with little power to genuinely repair the spirit. In many cases, my generation rejected them, seeking more modern relevance. Yet often we threw away the baby with the bathwater, desacralizing our sacraments in an effort to be more authentic, more real. What we fail to realize, however, is that the substance of sacred ritual is forever new and forever relevant. The problem lies not in rituals. The problem lies in the consciousness of those who perform them. Rituals become empty when imbued with empty thoughts. Those who overemphasize the external world don't know how to meet ritual, to imbue it with the kind of meaning that emanates from a heart truly open and vulnerable before God. Today, people are recognizing anew that rituals can create cellular shifts within us. If someone commits in a sacred ceremony to the care and protection of another, whether as parent, godparent, or mate, then that commitment carries a spiritual, emotional weight that no legal transaction can ever match. Rituals evoke a commitment of the heart. When the shadow of the hand of God has come over us, lifting us to new purpose or binding our heart to someone else's, bringing comfort when a loved one has died, or calling us to new magnificence and power, we know it. For the Holy Spirit is not metaphor or symbol. It is a living, alchemical power that infuses our hearts with the glory of God. I don't hear many people say anymore, "Why get married? It's just a piece of paper." For marriage, when placed within a sacred context, is not just a piece of paper. And more people today seem to realize that, yes, you do go to the funeral because it does make a difference. Prayers for the dead and prayers for their loved ones left on this earth create a field of blessing that is palpable, that is felt. It is not for nothing that the Holy Spirit is called the Comforter. We are emotionally healed as we allow ourselves to surrender to the sanctity of a Spirit-filled ceremony. We feel our souls have been bathed in light. Many people who might not have ever thought about it before now want their babies blessed and their adolescents to experience meaningful rituals marking this new stage of their lives. People are rediscovering the power of ritual, both in traditional and in non-traditional ways. We embrace rites of passage for adolescents and elders. We take vision quests and visit Native American sweat lodges. We perform solstice rituals and healing ceremonies for the earth. We create birthday ceremonies and sacred New Year's Eve services in which we surrender to God the disharmony of the year passing and ask for blessing on the year being born. As an officiant, what I have found many people want from rituals is not that they be fancy, but that they be genuine. We do not need the specific words of a pre-written text so much as we need authenticity before God. We do not need an ordained officiant to perform our ritual, so much as we need a Spirit-filled consciousness. And we do not need external glamour, but rather internal simplicity before the throne of God. And as we participate in the miraculous process of holy ritual, we feel ourselves expand into the space of a mythical reality. In a coming-of-age ceremony, a mother named Carol is no longer just Carol bowing before her daughter Amy as the young girl reaches puberty. She is every woman, honoring the emergence of every girl into adulthood. And from that point forward, Carol will not be the same, for something within her will have been altered. She has entered through a door that marks a greater fullness of her womanhood as mother, elder, and mentor to all young women. And Amy will have been altered as well, for she is no longer a young girl, but is now rather a young woman. This will affect her relationship to herself, to others, and to everything around her. Her psyche will rearrange itself, as her body already has. The spirit needs constant care and nourishment, just like the body, and it is a process that must go on continually. For ages, religious ritual has been used as preventative medicine, keeping our lives infused with light that we might be less vulnerable to darkness. In this country, we're very good about praying once tragedy has struck. But if we pray together more often, so much tragedy might not occur. A sacred ritual, even something as simple as lighting a prayer candle every morning, can make a tremendous difference in the quality of our lives. From the oracles of Delphi to the Passover Seder, from midnight mass on Christmas Eve to the beginning prayers of Ramadan, from chants on Buddha's birthday to the celebration of Krishna's triumphant presence, there are so many ways to elevate our relationship with God to the highest heights. We commune with Him, pour out our hearts to Him, receive Him, and are touched by Him. To the devoted heart, these are not just words. Whether saying a blessing or burying the dead, the moments when we reach out to God are the moments when our lives are graced with light. Every time a flower blossoms, God demonstrates His grace. Every time a snowflake forms, God demonstrates His grace. Every time spring comes around again, God demonstrates His grace. Every time a baby is born, God demonstrates His grace. And every time someone takes their final breath, God demonstrates His grace as well. We cannot match God's handiwork, but we can mirror His holiness. In every sacred ritual, we show Him our love, and He shows us His. We are reminded of the constant presence of an all-loving, all-giving, all-merciful God. A holy ceremony is an act of spiritual intimacy in which we connect deeply to our divine source. having touched, however faintly, the mind of God, our minds and even our bodies become illumined. Having received the blessing of our deep humanity, we finally realize that we are more than human. We are creatures of fertile earth and endless sky, meant to embody their full integration. We are floating in the waters of an amniotic spirit, within a cosmic womb out of which we will emerge angelic and joyful. Praise and thanks and music and tears transform us. The time has come for us to be reborn. The sacred moments of holy ritual are fragile and gentle, yet more powerful than the sea. And within the waters of that holy sea, we grow as our ancient ancestors grew. As they left the sea and climbed onto land, we now reach beyond the land to find our wings and fly. In time, we shall soar through the mystical skies as easily as we now walk on land. And life itself will be one long moment of gentle, unbroken grace. Sabbath. The fourth commandment is observe the Sabbath and keep it holy. It's amazing if you think about it, that observing the Sabbath is right up there with thou shalt not steal and thou shalt not kill. Why is it so important to God that we take one day out of every week and surrender it to Him? The wording in the Bible is, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. The Sabbath would be His day. Having a relationship with God is in many ways like having a relationship with anyone else. In order for it to blossom, we must take time for it and tend to it with genuine attention. Observing the Sabbath is like having a steady date with God, setting aside time in our calendar of days to dedicate to our connection with Him. And in remembering who God is, we remember who we are. Knowing ourselves clearly in relationship to God, we are stronger in our relationship with everyone and everything. As the leader of an interfaith spiritual fellowship, I have experienced the metaphysical power of a Sabbath service. For a Sabbath service is something more than just bodies gathered in a room. It is a convening of hearts and minds in an internal as well as external sanctuary. The mind is our true altar, and the heart our real sanctuary from the cruelty and limitations of the world. In Sabbath fellowship, we enter with others into the inner room. We go there to remember God, worship Him, and recommit our hearts to Him. We experience the stereophonic effect of amplified prayer emanating from the hearts of many. We participate in the creation of a devotional field of energy, which blesses its participants and remains with us when we leave the service. Like taking a trip to a chiropractor's office to have our spine realigned. We attend a Sabbath service to have our mind and heart realigned. The power of God is not outside us, but inside. And when the mind and heart are realigned with His Spirit, then His will is accomplished within us. Outside the blessing of that divine alignment, we are vulnerable to the machinations of the ego mind, where fear and chaos rule. The Sabbath is a day when the ego takes a rest. We keep our minds on God's love, both His love for us and the love He would have us share with each other. And that strengthens us internally, in ways that nothing else can do. Just as we recharge a computer or a cell phone, on the Sabbath, we recharge our souls. Day in and day out, most of us are preoccupied with essentially meaningless things. We know this grind is not in keeping with our heart's deepest desire, yet we often feel trapped by our ego's demands. Our lives revolve around concerns that do not resonate with the grandeur of our spiritual identity. And yet, unchecked, those concerns devour our energy and time. The purpose of the Sabbath is to interrupt this pattern of superficial preoccupation and return our minds to a path of holiness and peace. There was a musical very popular in my childhood called Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. Sabbath is a day when we simply get off the worldly merry-go-round and remember the truth of who we are. We are placed on this earth to love away the pain of the world. Yet we cannot do that when we ourselves are living so much at the effect of it. I had not expected when I first took a pulpit that the experience of a Sabbath service would be so different from any other spiritual lecture. And yet, in a subtle way, it is. There's something about people joining together specifically for a worship service on a specific day or holy day that makes the effect of prayer and prayerfulness particularly potent. That's what it means, I think, to say that God keeps the day hallowed. Jews don't have to go to synagogue on Friday or Saturday. Christians don't have to go to church on Sunday morning. But when we do, we join in an experience of fellowship not only with other worshipers, but with our ancestors and our descendants, that we might receive the spirit of a living God. Like boxers who go back to a corner when the bell rings to be attended to by handlers, on the Sabbath we go back to our own corner to be ministered to by angels. For angels are the thoughts of God. Sabbath is a day to remember His thoughts, to forgive ourselves and others, to reconcile ourselves with Him, to study more deeply the principles of truth, to pray for blessing and protection in the days ahead, and most of all, to commune with the miraculous spirit of true life as opposed to the spirit of shallowness and illusion that is, in fact, a living death. One Sunday morning, when conflict in the Middle East was at a particularly high and violent point, I chose as the topic for my Sunday sharing how we might spiritually help create peace between Israel and the Palestinians. I asked if anyone in the audience was a native Palestinian or an Arab who felt strongly about the Palestinian cause. A man put his hand up. I asked if anyone in the audience was a native Israeli or a Jew who felt strongly about Israel. A woman put her hand up. Then I asked both of them if they would be willing to participate in a healing ceremony. What followed was a prayerful apology, both by a Palestinian on behalf of his people, for all violence and transgressions perpetrated against Israel and Israelis, and an apology by an Israeli on behalf of her people for all violence and transgressions perpetrated by Israelis against Palestinians. In spiritual fellowship, our job is not to make a political stand for either Palestinians or Israelis, but rather to make a spiritual stand for both. Love makes a stand for eternal innocence, not worldly guilt, and we must stand on that love like a rock. On the Sabbath, we create a new conversation that humanity might grow into it. In holding to our conviction that all souls are innocent, we're helping to create the space in which that innocence will shine forth. The next evening, I participated in a peace circle along with several people who had been present at the Sabbath service the day before. One woman who had not been to that Sabbath service began to express her upset over the violence in the Middle East. As she spoke, it was obvious that she blamed one side more than the other, and as such, her mind was still at the level of the problem, not the answer. For the presumption of spiritual innocence is the only real answer. Those at whom we point a finger never represent our biggest problem. Our biggest problem is that we point a finger at all. For those of us who had been at the Sabbath service and experienced the spiritual power of the apologies, guilt didn't overwhelm our perceptions. Our minds were oriented differently, not taking sides in the battle, but lifted by God above the battlefield. And I realized again why the Sabbath is so important, why it is so essential to gather together and ask, how would God view this? Then for the rest of the week, we can be conduits of a wisdom that we could only have received from Spirit. We observe the Sabbath not in order to give up worldly things, but in order to give up a worldly perspective. Notice the commandment reads, "Observe the Sabbath." For in order to receive the blessing of the Sabbath, we must observe it. It's like the difference between knowing that the Super Bowl is on television today and actually sitting down to watch it. The idea and the experience are two different things. Bringing idea and experience together on the Sabbath, we recommit to our inner covenant with a living God. Then we are repaired and re-energized for the days ahead. Yet how are we to celebrate the Sabbath if we don't feel tied to a particular religion? The realization of spiritual realities supersedes doctrinal direction, and the Sabbath is a concept that transcends religion. We can make our own Sabbath service with friends at home. We might attend a Native American sweat lodge. We might light candles and say prayers, reading aloud from sacred texts, sharing a meal in fellowship and communion. Observation of the Sabbath is a movement within the heart, more than an external attendance at a religious service. And some people might feel a desire to observe the Sabbath in solitude, allowing the day to be one of communion with God, separate from fellowship or experience of community. God is everywhere, and He is in everything. Sabbath is important as the day we spend with Him, whatever that looks like and however it suits the individual. Modern mysticism doesn't seek to dictate worldly form, but to emphasize spiritual content. Like everything else, life is as deep or as shallow as we wish to play it. A holy Sabbath is in the depths of the spiritual sea, where the soul swims as deep as we are ready to swim, as far as we are prepared to go, and as close to God as we dare to be. As we swim toward Him, we realize He swims towards us. In awe and in rapture, at last we become the sea. Holidays. Holidays have become desanctified in America today. The firewall separating the concerns of commerce from the concerns of God now seems to have crumbled as we render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and frequently render unto him what is God's as well. Many of us know this and don't like it, yet the cultural undertow has been tugging at us for years. Like swimmers along the shore, we could have sworn we were far down the beach just a little while ago. We have no idea how we got where we are, having been pulled along by a force much more powerful than ourselves. Slowly and insidiously, the values of the marketplace have begun to dominate our entire culture. President's Day has become less a day to deeply honor great souls such as Abraham Lincoln and their contributions to the history of our nation than a day to take advantage of the President's Day sales at malls across America. A Memorial Day weekend has become less a day to deeply honor those who have died for our country than a weekend for barbecues, travel, and visiting friends. Christmas has become so commercialized that the miraculous birth of Jesus gets practically swallowed up by the materialism surrounding it. And Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday? Great, the kids can get a day off school. Days of honor thus become days of dishonor, as ego concerns take center stage time and time again, and the spirit of love, the spirit of God, is pushed aside. But those of us who wish for a deeper experience of the holidays should remember that we are responsible for our own thinking. We can embrace the deeper meaning of the holidays that matter to us, celebrating the days on which they occur from a place of serious wonder and awe. We don't need to go along with the pack. Indeed, we can consciously repudiate the shallower thought forms that pervade it. Sometimes you can feel there's an undertow, but choose to try to swim across it with every bit of strength that you have. Every year, weeks before Christmas and Hanukkah, I say to people, decide right now, are you going to give this season to God, or are you going to give this season to the ego? These holidays are about the birth of God and the arrival of miracles. They're about personal transformation and the emergence of a new self. They're not about whose relatives we're going to be with, who we have to buy gifts for, and whether or not we have the money to pay for all of them. Such material considerations rob our energy and eat away at our soul. Yet such anxiety-ridden dynamics will prevail if we surrender to the endless nagging of our ego mind. In surrendering a situation to God, we are asking Him to give us new thoughts and feelings about it. We are asking His help in de-emphasizing things that don't ultimately matter and focusing on what does. We are asking that His thoughts replace our own, that we be lifted by His Spirit to a lighter consciousness and thus a lighter life. The spiritual life is one of mental discipline in which we cleave to higher thought forms because we know they are key to our happiness and peace. Only in truth do we find a context for life that makes sense of our existence, and only deeper meaning assuages the suffering of the soul. When it comes to the temptation to make Christmas and Hanukkah more about the gifts of the catalog than the gifts of the Spirit, just say no. One rarely hears a Christian say, "I'm not going to Easter services this year because I already know what happens." One rarely hears a Jew say, "I'm not going to Passover Seder this year because I already know what happens." true, we know the stories intellectually. Jesus died on the cross, and then he rose. The Jews were in bondage, then Moses led them to the promised land. But religious stories are more than they appear. They are coded messages sent by God, heard by whatever part of our consciousness is open to receive them. If we meet the religious stories with shallow listening, they have shallow effects on our lives. The way we receive God's messages determines in large part what they are. Met superficially, the holidays are superficial. Met with genuine devotion, the holidays are transformative. They are as relevant to our lives as we allow them to be. So why does the mystic celebrate Christmas? Because the birth of Jesus heralds the opportunity for new life on earth, not just for one man, but for the entire human race. Christmas represents the spiritual possibility that we will leave behind who we used to be and become who we were created to be. Mary represents the soul, impregnated by the seed of God, giving birth to the highest possibility within us. We emerge as transformed beings, mothered by our humanity and fathered by God, risen at last to our true reality. The star of Christmas, the light that glowed in the darkened sky, is literally the realization that there lies within us such divine potential. Our mystical union with Mary and Jesus illumines not only our understanding, but the trajectory of our entire lives. It lifts us into the spiritual vortex of the truth their lives revealed. Why does the mystic celebrate Hanukkah? Because the oil that the Jews were burning in their lamps was not enough to guarantee their survival. Yet the oil continued to burn despite the laws of the physical universe. The Jew is reminded on Hanukkah that the God of our fathers is eternally there for us, aware of our suffering and committed to its end. He is the flame that casts out all darkness, for it is the light of God, not the light of the world, that nourishes us and sustains us. To know this and remember it is to keep our living covenant with him. And why does the mystic celebrate Easter? Because Jesus' resurrection demonstrated a power that casts out fear, even unto death itself. Be of good cheer, he said, for I have overcome the world. The message was not that Jesus had fixed the world, but rather that he had overcome it. He had achieved a perfect love, which then made him invulnerable to the lovelessness of the world. His consciousness had risen so high that in his presence all lower thought forms were rendered null and void. Yes, it would take a symbolic 3 days, but love prevailed for him, and love will now prevail for us as well. No matter what has happened, if we should hold on for those 3 days, standing on faith that love and forgiveness will work a miracle for us, then we too will experience a rising up as our hearts and our relationships receive new life. As long as we remain true to love, then love will remain true to us. That is the resurrection of Christ. Why does the mystic celebrate Passover? Because the slavery of the ancient Jews in Egypt is a slavery to which we can all relate. The Pharaoh of our ego mind would bind us to the meaninglessness and pain of a life of fear. Yet God lifted up his servant Moses as he lifts up hope in all of us. All of us feel the whip of Pharaoh, and all of us hear, if we listen well, the voice of Moses calling us out of slavery. Our bondage might be an addiction, a dysfunctional relationship, or a self-defeating pattern. And like some Israelites who initially resisted Moses, we fear the flight to freedom might be worse than our slavery. But in the words of A Course in Miracles, God will outwit our self-hatred. Finally, the Israelites were delivered, and we will be as well. Though God had to part the waters of the Red Sea to save the Jews from perishing, so he is willing to part the waters for us. In celebrating Passover, we remember that the God of Israel has been there for his people before and will be there always. God's love for us is so immense, we can scarcely recognize the dimensions of its mercy. To celebrate these holidays is to do much more than buy presents, open them, cook dinner, show up for dinner, or make children happy. The joy of holidays is not just for children. It's for each and every one of us when we realize the internal dimensions of the great religious holidays. The gift that needs to be unwrapped is the holiday itself. And one need not be Christian to experience the glory of Christ. or Buddhist to experience the power of the sutras, or Jewish to experience the comfort of God's promises. The mystic responds to universal spiritual themes, all echoing in a different way a unified message from God. The potential of a divinely empowered consciousness lies in every one of us. From Yom Kippur to Ramadan to solstice celebrations to Christmas to Shivaratri, the great religious holidays, as well as civil holidays celebrating noble civic principles, are ways in which humanity is reminded to keep faith with what is true. We appreciate the miraculous possibilities that the holidays provide. That on Christmas morning, for instance, millions of people consider the possibility of a perfect love. That on Passover, the Jewish people consider the possibility that God is here to deliver them even now. That on Easter morning, millions of people consider the possibility that through love we can transcend all limitations of the world. Such is the power of the religious holidays when we consider their invisible influence on hearts throughout the world. And how do we participate in the mystical meaning of the holidays? Through prayer, quiet, spirit-filled ceremony or fellowship, reading, or any cultivation of deeper meaning that works for us. We might fast or meditate, sing or build altars in our homes. We might read spiritual books with our families or create new rituals that deepen our experience of ageless truths. And most important, we pray. For prayer, in the words of A Course in Miracles, is the conduit of miracles. We need simply pray that God reveal to us, in our own life, the meaning of a holiday. And then watch what happens. He will do the rest. Once we recognize the real power of holidays, we begin to approach them with deeper devotion. A holiday is a holy day, and holiness doesn't happen to us. Holiness is a choice we make, and holidays are portals of energy through which the experience of things that matter most are increased within us and in the world in which we live. Bear witness to what happened to someone else 2 or more thousand years ago, and you will enter the timeless dimension in which it is happening to you. Relationships. French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre wrote that hell is other people. People are heaven too, of course, when relationships go well and people behave the way we wish. Either way, people are hard to get away from in this world, and our relationships with others go far toward determining our happiness or lack of it. I remember that when my daughter was a baby, I kept wishing she could talk because I wanted to have a conversation with her. And now that she's talking as fast and as much as her mother, I remember how sweet it was when no matter what I said, she just looked up at me adoringly, giggling, and never argued. So, if you want sweet and cuddly relationships with no disagreements, you might want to hang around infants. But if you want intelligent dialogue, you better get out your magic wands. People over the age of 3 have a way of saying what they actually think, which may or may not make your day. The character of our relationships ranges from the heights of enlightenment to the depths of destruction, and most of us have been privy to both at some point in our lives. As with any other situation, the key to making and keeping relationships harmonious lies in placing them in the hands of God. To place a situation in the hands of God, as we know, is to place our thinking in the hands of God. It means we're asking His Spirit to enter our minds and guide our perceptions. We're asking Him to help us remain focused on the divine essence in someone else and help them remain focused on the divine essence in us. We are asking that the possibilities of the present, not the mistakes of the past, guide our perceptions of each other and ourselves. The key to right relationship, and every situation is in some way a relationship, is to allow each one, in every moment, to be lifted from the past. A relationship is reborn whenever we see someone as they are right now and don't hold them to who they were. Focus on the present, not the past, is essential to the experience of grace. Relationships represent assignments made by divine intelligence, bringing together those who represent the greatest opportunities for learning from each other. In every relationship, there's an endless stream of potential healing, both for the people joined in the original encounter and for countless others they will meet in turn. In A Course in Miracles, relationships are referred to as laboratories of the Holy Spirit. Each one is a temple of God, blessed by love and innocence, or desecrated by fear and guilt. which it is up to us. The mystic is always guarding his or her thoughts, seeking to drop the thoughts that condemn and extend the thoughts that bless. For there is no such thing as a thought that goes unnoticed by the universe. This is both exciting and horrifying when we think about it, for we can all be so judgmental at times, even toward those we truly love. Yet our own emotional reality is ultimately our own responsibility. We can decide to bless someone, even when we don't like their behavior, and in so doing we're freed from the limited vision by which we judged them to begin with. It's our willingness to see the innocence in someone, even when they've shown us their guilt, that gives us the capacity to transform both their experience and our own. While we were born with a perfect capacity to love, each of us is tempted by the realities of life to withhold our love and defend against pain. Compassion, defenselessness, and unconditional love are much easier to express before we become aware of how dangerous life and love can be. Only very small children and saints are really all that good at it. Yet, our alternative to reaching for the angels is to slide down the slippery slope to hell. And hell is not a place we go after we die. Hell is right here on earth, and all of us have visited it at one time or another. It's the suffering of separation from those with whom we are already joined as one. For separation from others is a separation from God, and nothing hurts more nor drives us more insane. There is something to learn from every encounter. If someone is kind to us, the lesson is to be grateful, to not take their kindness for granted, and most importantly, to graciously return their kindness. If someone is not kind, the lesson is to rise above that, because reacting to them is like throwing gasoline on a fire. Anger does nothing more than deplete our personal power. While remaining open, defenses down, is like depriving the fire of oxygen. Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis once said to a friend, "Only amateurs stay mad." A Course in Miracles teaches us to interpret all behavior as either love or a call for love. Someone who behaves in a non-loving way has simply forgotten who they are, and the role of the mystic is to remind them of the truth by remaining in touch with it ourselves. Our job is to remain awake to the eternal innocence at the heart of everyone, that in our presence other people might wake up to it as well. The light in our own mind will help dissolve the darkness in someone else's, but only if we refuse to judge or blame them for what we view as their mistakes. Our perception of someone's essential innocence as a child of God is the light in a metaphysical sense, while our focus on someone's guilt is the darkness. To cast light on something simply means to cast upon it a greater understanding. If we are in serious conflict with someone, there are often limits to how much can actually be achieved by personal communication. On the level of personality, the walls that divide us can be too thick to tear down through mortal means alone. Phone calls, letter writing, or conversation are not always restorative measures. Sometimes we say we've communicated with someone when all we really did was to share our own viewpoint. The word communication has the same root as the word communion, and when there's no communion, there's no true communication. Only when we have taken responsibility for the emotional ground on which we stand with someone, practicing humility and forgiveness as best we can, do we create a heart space for real communication. When the walls that divide us seem impenetrable, we can repair to our inner room, our holy sanctuary, to spiritually work out our differences with others. When we dedicate our relationship to God at its genesis, we are ministered to by angels as we progress within the relationship. And whether we have dedicated it or not, the key to healing relationships is to go back to God, asking for a miraculous shift in perception from guilt and fear to innocence and love. Sometimes both parties are willing to join in prayer and ask for this, and sometimes only one is willing. Yet one is enough. According to A Course in Miracles, whoever is saner at the time can call on the Holy Spirit to enter a relationship, and no prayer goes unheard. In the inner room, there are no differences between or among us. Whether an argument between friends or a war between nations, God does not choose sides. Rather, He removes the walls that divide us. Those walls primarily live in our minds, and it is God's love reaching beyond the level of human drama that has the power to dissolve them. It finds a way to remind us who we are. It delivers us from the drama of who did what to whom, and to the truth of our innocence regardless of who did what to whom. By looking to the sky instead of to the earth for answers, we spread our wings and fly above trials and tribulations that otherwise might keep us down. For it is only in looking beyond a problem that we have the power to resolve it. Everyone makes mistakes. We all have bad days, get in rotten moods, and say or do things we wish we hadn't. We would be much better off, and certainly our relationships would improve, were we to take every moment's word and deed less seriously, and to trust in the deeper intentions of the heart. I once heard something nasty someone said about me, and I shared my distress with a mutual friend. He said to me, "Well, she might have said it, but that doesn't change the fact that I know she loves you." When he said that, I remembered how often I've made flip judgmental comments about people I love, and how horrified I would have been had they had heard about it. It didn't really matter if my friend had said something unkind about me. It was up to me whether to attach meaning to it or release it as not important. On the spiritual mountaintop, we will be kind to one another all the time. But in the meantime, we can stop taking it so seriously when we are not. Even if someone doesn't like you, they love you whether they know it or not. And it's worth telling them that in meditation. "I know you dislike me, but I refuse to dislike you. I hold to the truth of our connection as God created it. I hold to the truth of our inner oneness, and I invite the Spirit of God to enter here and dissolve the walls between us. I forgive you, and I ask that you please forgive me." Jesus said to love our enemies and bless those who curse us. To pray for someone is to pray that they be returned to their right minds. What a thought, given the state of the world today. Holiness surrounds a relationship with light, so that the darkness of blame and judgment has less chance of clouding our thoughts to begin with. That's why the beginning of a relationship is such a perfect time to surrender it to God, before the ego has a chance to claim it. Beginnings set the tone for what will follow. "Dear God, I place in your hands my relationship with this person. May our relationship serve you. May we see each other through the eyes of love, that only light might enter here. Thank you, God. Amen." The more mindful and responsible we become, the fewer relationship disasters we create in our lives. Yet none of us is perfect, and any deep and genuine relationship is bound to arouse temptations to fear instead of love. Yet it's by being forced to recognize the times when we're not yet purely loving, surrendering them and letting them go, that we grow into the angels we are capable of being. All of us have done or said things we regret. Yet the value of such experiences is that the next time we do things differently. We often learn how we want to behave in this life by having behaved otherwise and felt pain as a result. It is prayer that releases us at such times if we're willing to humble ourselves. Sometimes it's very difficult to admit to ourselves, to God, and particularly to other people, that we have been wrong and we ask forgiveness. Yet it is only when we genuinely come clean with God that He can heal our lives. While we instinctively understand the power of prayer when there's been a problem, we tend to underestimate its power when there's not. We don't usually stop to say a prayer before the meeting, or before the date, or before the relationship gets going. We think, "Why should I say a prayer now? There's no problem." But the sly and insidious ego is always on the alert for ways to separate the children of God, just as God is always on the alert for ways to reconnect our hearts. Prayer has a way of rendering the ego powerless, reminding the mind of our eternal innocence. Relationships are where the ego seeks to do battle with the will of God. In reality, there is no battle, for those whom God hath joined together, and He has joined all of us to all of us, cannot be put asunder. It is only our thinking that we're separate from others that dooms us to conflict and struggle and pain. Often when someone criticizes us, the pain of their judgment makes it difficult for us to realize that some aspect of what they're saying might be correct. While the message may be delivered in words that seem unfair, there's often still a message worth hearing. The more spiritually mature mind burns through the pain of hearing important information from someone whom we'd rather not hear from at all, asking, "Is there some personality trait I've been carrying around for years that is possibly contributing to someone's dislike? Is it something I might surrender and transform?" The work of the mystic is not so much to make ourselves better as to be honest about who we are right now. When we're candid with ourselves and with God, then we can release to Him the issues that we know need healing and thus be purified by His Spirit. Our best intentions to act better don't mean all that much. Our willingness to have Him make us better means everything. And it is not always our own darkness. Indeed, sometimes it's the very fact that we've shown our light that attracts other people's judgment. But then a profound lesson lies in realizing how threatening our own light can be. It's important to be conscious of that, lest we subconsciously dim our light in order not to offend anyone. And we can pray for protection and humility as we shine in our world. And there's no dearth of light on this planet. There's just way too much of it that remains inside us, not shining at all. And that is part of the darkness of the world, how afraid we are to shine our own light. In asking God to help us shine, we're asking that His light shine through us to bless the entire world. Dear God, may Your light burst forth within me to bathe my inner self and shine through me to bless all living things. Amen. We are on the earth to be joyful and to share our joy with others. The spirit looks to relationships as a place to share our happiness, while the ego looks to them to assuage our pain. Our fundamental loneliness, however, lies not in our separation from others, but in our separation from self. To say that we are separated from God is not to say that we're separated from something outside ourselves, for God does not lie outside ourselves. It is to say that we are fragmented inside, having experienced a profound split from our own essential nature. We have been lured away by the illusions of the world. To look for the experience of home in anything within the material world is to make the world a trap, for it is not our home. It's a fantastic hotel at best. The realm of physical things, the body included, is the realm of separation, not of true joining. Knowing that, making the focus of our attention the connection of spirits rather than the connection of bodies gives us a fundamental spiritual sanity that serves us well in relating to others. Otherwise, we search the world for something to heal the pain that results from our being too attached to it already. Usually, we will look to other people to fix us. We're tempted to enter into relationships on a search for the lost self we cannot find. Yet, outside ourselves, we cannot find what only lies within. When we look to another person to complete us, we doom the relationship because we're subconsciously looking to it to be what it is not. And every time I reach a place in our relationship where I'm not in touch with myself, I will behave in a way that repels you. For if I am a yo-yo with myself, then I will be a yo-yo with you. That is why healing our inner life is a prerequisite for relating successfully to others. My family has often joked about the fact that when my mother was pregnant with me, she and my father both felt sure that I was a boy. My father wanted to name me Mordecai. My mother told him in no uncertain terms that I would not be named Mordecai, but it became a joke around the house nevertheless. He said Mordecai, she said Michael, and I have no doubt she would have prevailed had she given birth to a boy. She did not, of course. Yet when my mother brought me home from the hospital, we were greeted at the family apartment with signs all over the place that read, "Welcome home, little Mordecai." Now, my mother and I still disagree about this decades later, but I swear to you, I remember those signs. It was like, great, they wanted somebody else. And in many ways, as I went through my life, I would recreate that drama in my relationships with others. Feeling in various ways unreceived in my childhood, I desperately sought to be received by others in my later years. But I didn't know how to genuinely accept others into my life because the pattern had not been modeled for me, so others would end up feeling that I was waiting for Mordecai and not for them. It took a lot more than rational analysis to interrupt that pattern. It could not be broken by finding another person who would finally, ultimately accept me fully. That could not and would not happen until first I repaired my own underlying wound by learning to accept myself. I learned that I'm welcomed to life by God, and that my job is to help others feel welcome as well. Love is the miracle of a heart rewired by God. In accepting God, we learn to accept one another. Very few of us have felt consistently throughout our lives that our spirits were truly welcomed on this earth, and that's why we have suffered here. but we find that the way to heal a heart that was not received is by learning to receive others. A man once asked me if I knew any prayers for loneliness. I asked why he was looking for such a prayer. What was wrong with his relationship with others? He said he tried to get close to people, but always ended up behaving in a way that was perceived as either needy or haughty. He just wanted a prayer to ease the pain. And I understood. But just as we wouldn't pray to simply assuage the pain of a broken leg, we would pray that the leg be healed as well. I suggested that he pray for God's healing of his neediness and haughtiness first. Somewhere there was a place where his spirit did not feel received, and so it went to sleep to avoid the pain. There in that place, the hand of God, not the hand of man, has the capacity to heal us. God did not wish for us to be lonely, and in the fullness of ourselves we are not. But God is not found outside our relationship with the rest of life. He is our relationship with the rest of life. When our desire to relate to life is a desire to share our joy, extending beyond thoughts that would separate us to thoughts that would bless and unite us with others, then loneliness fades. The key is not to build relationships. The key is to give up the many concepts that shroud us from this awesome fact. We are related already. We are each other. How much more related can we be? With every human encounter, God gives us the chance to recreate our world. We can extend beyond the boundaries of our isolated existence and bless the person, salute the angel, open our hearts to the similarly wounded one who stands before us. Or we can refuse to do those things, feeling the pain of having someone else withhold from us the blessing, the salute, the love. There is nothing and no one outside us so much as there are mirrors everywhere. Every person is a part of us, and we are a part of every person. Sacred the chalice that holds us together, and painful the thoughts that would tear us apart. Both are within us. It is ours to choose. And we do choose. Constantly, may we choose the divine. Community. It has been said that when the Buddha comes again, he will arrive not as a person, but as a community. We will know that God is here on earth when we can see him in one another. Once when I was in my early 20s, I lived in a house in San Francisco with several other people. In the dining room overlooking the city, there was a very long table at which there were always people drinking coffee and engaging in lively conversation at almost any time of the night or day. That was a period in my life in which I thought of my future as more important than my present. Surely in my future I would find the secret to happiness. But now that I'm living what my younger self thought of as the future, I look back at that table and think, that was it. There at that table, I remember having my first and still one of my most potent experiences of community. My house today is nicer, to be sure. Like others of my generation, I graduated into my own this, my own that. But also, like others of my generation, I kind of miss the old days when there was more connection and less competition, more community and less isolation, more conversation and less TV. Today, when we think about people joining together, it's not always for such wonderful purposes. We know about terror cells made up of terrorists joined for the purpose of wreaking havoc on our world. We get chills as we realize the power of two or more terrorists joined together, exerting greater power than the sum of the individuals. Yet the power of joining together applies as much, in fact much more, to those who love than to those who hate. For there is a cosmic propulsion behind love that there is not behind hate. Our problem is not that hate is more powerful than love, because indeed it is not. Our problem is that hatred today is more energetic and proactive than love. It's time for our generation to not only allow ourselves the satisfaction of deep love and community, but also the power of deep love and community. It is the greatest antidote to the darkness of our times. Metaphysically speaking, God did not create us individually, but as one. That is the esoteric meaning of only one begotten Son. The awareness of our oneness, while foreign to the ego, is clear to the heart. And that's why unity is the key to our happiness. Spiritually, we do not exist in isolation. It is unnatural for us to perceive ourselves as separate. In fact, we're like sunbeams of the same sun and waves of the same ocean. Imagining ourselves as separate waves, we feel that we're tiny and powerless, when in fact we are integral to the immense power of the sea. It's only when we transcend the illusion of separation, refusing the false testimony of our physical senses, that we will make the quantum leap forward into joy-filled life. We will know peace when we learn to love as God loves, and God loves all of us as one. We were created as one, and we remain as one. The golden rule is so fundamental because what we do to others, we literally are doing to ourselves. The recognition of our unity is the healing of all our wounds. Yet how do we convert the consciousness of humanity to a perspective of spiritual oneness? And what would the world look like if we did? Every once in a while, we give ourselves a taste of what life on Earth could be like, were we to truly interact like brothers and glimpse a higher possibility for connection among us. On the final day of the last millennium, as people geared up for New Year's Eve celebrations all over the world, television networks broadcast fireworks displays from London to Sydney, New York to Hong Kong. I remember a particular moment that day when I was simply walking through my living room, becoming aware of the sense that the entire world was in love. I didn't have the feeling of being in love with a particular person, but of love as a feeling that filled the air, an all-pervasive sweetness such as I had never known. I felt everyone was capable of loving everyone. And in that moment I thought, this is how life is supposed to feel. It's how we will feel one day when we've evolved to our divine potential. Love did not feel like the exception. It felt like the rule that day. The air itself was peaceful in a way we do not ordinarily experience. A friend who lives in New York City told me about her remarkable experience on day one of the year 2000 as she was on her way to work. She told me the subway was like one big party. Everyone was celebrating. Everyone was kind to each other. People who didn't even know one another were talking and joking. Many of these same people had been riding to work together every day for months or even years, and yet what a difference a day made. So what really happened on that day? Was there actually an external objective shift of some sort? Or rather, for one shining moment, did our social contract simply change? What spell of peace and goodwill came upon us? And why, like Cinderella at the stroke of midnight, did we feel compelled at day's end to go back to who we were before? Just as Abraham Maslow asserted that studying psychologically well-adjusted people was more revealing in the end than studying those who were psychologically impaired, it behooves us to question what is really going on in those moments when we come together in peace. The truth is, nothing objectively occurred on New Year's Day as we entered this millennium. What did occur is that for the period of about one day, we gave ourselves permission to behave like brothers. We accepted a universal love that day, beyond the confines of a particular relationship to an individual or group. Our natural knowing superseded our ego, and we entered into a different unspoken agreement with one another. This was not to be a day for competition, but for cooperation. Not a day for war, but for peace. Not a day for judgment, but for blessing. And not a day for unhappiness, but for celebration. Nothing more than a simple shift in how we saw life made the difference that day. It was an internal, not an external power that tilted us toward the light. We simply changed our perspective. From that shift in our thinking, there arose, if only for a brief time, a different kind of world. For one day, the focus of our attention and genius was on the celebration of life. We saw the world we would want to see, because on that day, it was what we decided to see. For that one day, we got it right. And if we could do it for a day, then isn't it reasonable to assume that we could do it for longer? My point is surely idealistic. But what more is an ideal than a thought that has not yet descended from heaven to earth, a thought that awaits the evolution of the human race to be accepted and made manifest? Wasn't the abolition of slavery once merely an ideal? Wasn't women's suffrage once merely an ideal? Wasn't the end of Britain's colonial rule in India once merely an ideal? Idealism, after all, is not a neurosis. What is neurotic is how little idealism we display anymore. How lacking in imagination we've become about anything beyond individual goals. Now is the time for collective goals and collective ideals, as our near fanatical adherence to the belief in separation has reached such dangerous proportions. Realism is not particularly helpful when what is real is so painful to witness. What is idealism, after all, but a message from the real to the ultimately unreal? It's the force that inspires us to improve the world with a deep inner knowing that something better is possible. An ideal is a pure idea which becomes miraculous when blended with human imagination and effort. Great ideas need not languish in the realm of abstract possibility. They're meant to be embodied. Through the willingness of people and the grace of God, they become part of our earthly experience whenever we choose. Another example of a heightened state of group awareness occurs every 2 years at the Olympic Games. While charges of corruption have soiled their reputation at times, the fundamental sensibility of the Olympics is one of enlightened, joy-filled competition. The unique talents and brilliance of all nations are on display in a stunning demonstration of human community. As the athletes march in for the opening ceremonies, our hearts thrill at the reminder of how things could be. We see nations of the world recognizing each other as fellow citizens of this planet, all created with special talents, expressing themselves fully, and delighting in one another's magnificence. We get a glimpse of what's possible, and we can feel that the Olympic torch symbolizes something much more than sportsmanship. There's a universal sanctity to its flame, as it clearly represents a light that shines in every person and every heart, calling us to wholeness of body, mind, and spirit. Comparing the Olympics to the state of our world today, we are tempted to despair. It is hard to accept the simultaneous reality of such noble genius as Olympian athleticism and terrorist destruction. Yet both exist, and both are real within our experience. They arise from very different views of our purpose on this earth, and one, not both, will ultimately prevail. It's important for the spiritual activist to remember that things could be different in our world, that the moments we experience as magnificent exceptions could indeed become the rule. Robert F. Kennedy often quoted George Bernard Shaw in saying, "Some people see things as they are and ask why. I think of how they could be, and I ask, why not?" Children holding flowers could greet us when we arrive in a new country, instead of customs agents and guards. People could live in abundance and peace, instead of poverty and war. Life could be a continuous dance of harmony for everyone, instead of a desperate struggle to survive for so many. Once we are ready to accept such a vision and consider it possible, because in God all things are possible, then our lives will become the channels through which it will emerge. It's only a failure of imagination that keeps us stuck in patterns of limitation and fear. There is a new peace movement emerging today among those who realize that our spiritual powers afford us tremendous opportunity to transform the world. We can imagine the world we want. We can become the people from whom that world would flow forth. And we can join with others in making it happen. As we create deeper peace among any of us anywhere, the reality of peace becomes more probable everywhere. We can surround the world with a field of peace so powerful that hatred and fear will dissolve in its presence. Scientists tell us we live in a holographic universe, which means that on the level of energy, the whole is contained in every piece, and every piece contains the whole. So it is that a healing between or among any of us helps to heal all of us. Anytime walls that divide us melt, the world is brought closer to the reuniting of hearts, which is the mystical goal of human existence. Peace is more than the absence of war. It's the presence of peace, a positive state of being predicated on justice and brotherhood and love. And in its presence, injustice and hatred have little power to grow. That is why knowing the truth of our spiritual oneness and embracing it within our hearts is the ultimate answer to all the problems of the world. At the level of spiritual reality, none of us are black or white, Palestinian or Israeli, American or Afghani. The body has differences, the spirit does not. Community arising from the realization of our oneness is community that goes beyond mere alliance or treaty. It stems from a knowing of the heart, which transforms the mind. emerging from our depths, it touches others in the same place, and thus what was broken apart shall be mended. The horrors of the world we live in today arise from spiritual ignorance. Until we reach that place in ourselves where we identify with one another beyond our differences, we will perpetuate the disharmony that results from spiritual immaturity. Technological and material progress, alas, are not necessarily accompanied by spiritual wisdom. Often, in fact, our material power is used by the ego as a way to resist the truth. Yet the truth remains and catches up with us in time. There's no material shield that our karma will not penetrate. We cannot escape one another, and in our right minds we wouldn't want to. Spending extraordinary resources trying to protect ourselves from our fellow human beings, rather than on efforts to build righteous relationships, is a backward model of human interaction. And the fact that we don't quite know how to turn our civilization from a war machine into a peace machine is not a reason not to try. Perhaps all the problems on the earth today provide us an opportunity, a challenge to surrender to the truth in our hearts. Perhaps the mortal mind has been pushed at last into the proverbial corner, where we'll admit to our inability to save ourselves, indeed to our genius at destroying ourselves, and humbly ask God to do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. Man is very effective at waging war. God is most effective at waging peace. We will be brothers and sisters in peace, and not war, when that is what we most deeply desire. Until then, we will face the consequences of our not yet having chosen love as the organizing principle for human civilization. Building genuine connection and deep community among the peoples of the world is the historical task of our generation. Where our governments do not seem equal to that task, indeed, in some cases, they clearly repudiate it, we ourselves must strive to accomplish it nevertheless. With love in our hearts, we can supersede all fear-based consciousness, no matter how much material power it might wield. We will forge a new field of human possibility in which war shall be no more. In the meantime, we will continue to gravitate to long dining room tables where friends await us. We will continue to fall in love on blessed, enchanted days. And we will continue to fervently love our children and watch the miraculous show of their dance into adulthood. But there will be more. Now, in an extraordinary moment of global transformation, we will do more than just love. We will join our love and harness our love. We will pool our resources of forgiveness and imagination, passion and grace, and in time we will collectively experience what physicists call phase lock, a phenomenon in which individual oscillating rhythms, here the beats of many, many hearts around the world, fall into a deep pattern of energetic resonance. We will form a community of consciousness, a collective love, that is humanity's next step on our evolutionary journey. Love is not meant to be alone. It reaches out to find itself at every opportunity. Scientists tell us about phase lock, not that it always happens, but that it is always trying to happen. No matter how much havoc fear and hatred wreak, God has a better plan that is incapable of failure. It lacks not power, but adherence. It waits simply for us to say yes to love as energetically as hatred says no. That shall be the deliverance of the world when we arise from our stupor and faithlessness and doubt and create the world we were born to create. First, we will do this in tiny increments and at last in waves of huge significance. An awe-filled grace will fill the skies and flood our hearts when we remember at last who we are to one another, that we are one another. Praise God.